Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week at our kitchen table, right in the middle of KHOI Community Radio. And this is a community-supported, volunteer-based organization. We do lots of good things here. Welcome to our table. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to themuckyduckpub.com or just call the pub and ask for Marcus.
Like I said, welcome. We're going to talk about lots of good things today, kind of a potpourri, a potluck of things. We have lots of news items.
Lots of summertime things.
And that's good, too. There's some farmer's market update things and some berries I've been picking. There's sorbet, granita, and tomatoes. We're going to talk about tomatoes, and we're going to have a special guest on later in the show talking about sheep. Sheep and a Scandinavian tradition that is just lovely. So stick around, stick around. I have a little bit to say about what's at the market. I mean, this is the time of year when farmers markets all over Iowa are just
yummy. It's the beginning
of
our happy time.
Oh, it is.
Oh, yeah.
People smile. It may be hot. It may be kind of uncomfortable summer weather out there. But the Iowa State Fair is coming up. The corn is green and everything is lovely. And people are talking sweet corn. There's sweet corn for sale.
Oh, good sweet corn. Oh,
and I had my first small picking of okra. Almost caused a riot at farmer's market. But lots of good things.
Looking good this year, the okra?
Oh, I think so.
The okra forecast, Lana? Give us the okra forecast.
The okra forecast is short now, but it will get taller, which I hope it will, because it's really hard to bend over to pick the little suckers. But once it gets about waist high or head high, it's really fun to pick. I enjoy okra.
Excellent.
Yeah,
excellent. We love a good okra.
And music. There's good music at farmers market always. I vend at a market in downtown Ames, Iowa on Main Street. So it's a long, skinny sort of thing. And I'm kind of in the middle of the street there. And at one end and at the other end, there's usually music going on. And I can hear it, but it's not like right in my ear, which is good. But there's always music going on. The Reds Band, a local band. Reds Band was there last week. Everybody loves Reds. It's good. And a couple weeks ago, one of my favorite musicians and songwriters, local songwriter, Rick Exner was there. He was singing along. He has actually written a lot of fun songs. And if you ever catch him at Farmer's Market or any other place, ask him to sing the Farmer's Market song. I happened to walk up to where he was playing solo with his guitar and singing away there. And he was singing his Farmer's Market song. It's really a fun one. It talks about farmer's market. I'll see you there down at the station or out on the square. Also, it's got a great line in it. He talks about different vendors and what's available at farmer's market. And it's a great line in it. It's talking about things you can find there, including hot empanadas and gooseberry pie. This is where I want to go when I die. But not soon. Oh, sirree, no. At that farmer's market, it's fun. It's fun.
It's true. It's a little bit of heaven.
Also, blueberries. Blueberries are in.
So finally, blueberry season is upon us.
It is, and we have a fine place over by Nevada, Iowa.
The berry patch.
They have got blueberries up the wazoo there, and they were at farmer's market, too.
Now, and it's a you pick. You can go there and pick yourself, take your kids. It's a wonderful family adventure. It's very pretty out there.
Yep.
Or you can just buy them already picked if you don't want to pick them. There's options. They are going to have a good apple season, we hope, too. They have marvelous apples, all kinds of varieties.
Good. Anyway, I was out there a week or so ago and picking those blueberries, and the blueberries last for a while.
It's good to get out there a little bit before the noonday sun.
Hint, hint. Anyway, when I was checking out and talking to Mike Henry there at the checkout stand there and bagging up the blueberries that I picked, he turned to me and he wished me a Merry Christmas because it was only 5 months until Christmas. Yes, and so we wished each other all the joys of the season, and it was true. Even though here we are, things are going to move fast. So it was 5 months until Christmas.
Yep, we're in the home stretch of the year, right?
Donna, you had a few things happening this week. Comment on sorbet and granita and that sort of thing.
In case no one knows, the Cook's Emporium, our lovely local cook store on Main Street, has had a remodel, and into that remodel they built a fabulous teaching kitchen. Quite deluxe, I must say. And they are running a series of classes. So I have been teaching a few, and this week I did granita and sorbet, and I threw a panna cotta in there. Kind of all of these are little cold desserts that are great for warm weather. And I chose them because they're really easy to do. So granita, we did a coffee granita with a whipped cream on top. So granita is this really simple, it's like slushies for adults, kind of think about. And it's really simple. You take a water-based, you can either use a fruit juice, or I used coffee, but something that's a water-based so it will crystallize. And then you put it in a rather shallow and sweeten it. Of course, remembering that when something is cold, the sensation of sweetness, as all the other flavors, will decrease slightly. So you take a metal, like I used an old pie pan. A metal pan conducts the temperature more quickly, and you pour the liquid shallow, like half an inch is really, really good. The deeper you pour it, first of all, the messier it can be in the freezer, but also the longer it takes to freeze. So I kind of did about a quart, maybe a less, maybe 3 cups of fairly strong espresso coffee, which I chilled in the refrigerator first, and I sweetened it before I chilled it. So I put it in about a half an inch in the coffee pan, in the pie pan. And then every 15 minutes, you open the freezer and you take a fork and you stir it, breaking up the crystals. It kind of starts to freeze more along the sides, and you just kind of keep the crystals broken up in a uniform fashion. And eventually, between an hour to an hour and a half, depending on the temperature of your freezer and the depth of your mixture, it will form these nice little crystals, like a very, not quite as fine as a snow cone or as snow, a little chunkier. And once it's really frozen nicely and you've broken them all up, then you just put it into some other container and leave it in the fridge. So with the coffee granita, I made it fairly sweet, and then I made a whipped cream, which I did not sweeten too much. I wanted it to have a little contrast. So for like a dinner, a charming serving of that is to take it an espresso cup, spoon it full of the granita, and then top it with the whipped cream, and then put it on its little saucer with one of the smaller teaspoons, a Demitasse spoon. Oh. And that is a really very easy to make. And you can do the same thing for children. They really like this sort of thing, too, if you're not the coffee one. But, you know, like if you wanted to take a bunch of strawberries and puree them with some water in the blender and some sugar. And then with strawberries, I'd probably strain it to get the seeds out, and then freeze that. And then you have a little strawberry granita. You know, all kinds of good tricks. And if you wanted to get really fancy, you could take some rose geranium and make a rose geranium sugar syrup by steeping the rose geranium in the water and then adding the sugar and then straining the whole thing.
I like that.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah. And then you just chill it all in the fridge before you try and freeze it, because that, you know, hastens the stirring time. But it's a very simple thing to do. It's something that, you know, probably older children would also enjoy doing.
Or do themselves.
Yes, huh? Exactly. So we did, that's granita, G-R-A-N-I-T-A is what that's called. Then I also hauled in my wonderful ice cream machine, and I took my own in because it is the kind that has the compressor in it. So a lot of ice cream machines, you have to freeze the bowl in your freezer, And then you have to start, of course, with your mixture very cold because the freezing capacity of this previously frozen bowl is fairly limited. So if you're making homemade ice cream with any of those kinds of machines, and they're price-wise much more accessible, basically it's a freezer bowl thing with an electric paddle churn. But mine has it has the churn, and it has two buttons. One runs the freezer compressor, and the other one makes the thing churn around.
Yeah, and it's about the size of a toaster oven, sort of thing.
A big one.
But yeah.
It's a fairly substantial, an Italian ice cream maker. But I've had it for probably 20 years. I use it all the time. I've done things like take it to grade schools. Kids love seeing ice cream made. You know, they like the idea of, oh, this is... I don't know what's exciting about it, but you take the machine in, you push the button, and you pour the mixture in, and they get really excited. So I have used this for many occasions for educational purposes. And once again, so for the sorbet, and you can make sorbet or ice cream. I did a sorbet. It's, as we all know, it's peach season, and we are having a dandy peaches this year. The Georgia peaches have been good. The Missouri peaches have been good. The California peaches have been good. And now we're starting to get the Colorado peaches. Not much for Iowa peaches, but we're not known for our peach growing. So what I did with the peaches was, and the fun part for the class, there's a really easy technique that works both on peaches and tomatoes where you take a pot of boiling water, you just drop the fruit in for very quickly, less than a minute, certainly.
Oh, yeah. I think like 20 seconds, 30 seconds.
Yeah, not very long, yeah. Depending, you know, on the thickness of the skin. And then with a slotted spoon, you just lift them out. And then as soon as they're cool enough to touch, like with the peaches, I just slice them in half around that mid-seam. And you twist to get it off the pit. And as you're twisting, the skin just slides right off. And I have to say... Before I was setting up the class, I said to the young lady, Rachel, who helps run the classes over there, do you think we should show this part of it, skinning the peaches? She said, oh, I think everybody probably knows this. But, I had the peaches. We had to peel them anyway. So I just thought, well, let's just do it. And that was the part of the class that people got the most excited about. It is a nifty trick.
A crowd pleaser.
Absolutely. So peeling the peaches that way and equally well with tomatoes. Since it is the season. So for this recipe, I had made a simple syrup, which is sugar and water. It's traditionally two parts water to one part sugar. I make mine a lot less sweet. I maybe do a quarter of sugar because I'm just trying to reduce sugar in my diet. And it just tastes too sweet otherwise. So in mine, I steeped some anise hyssop from the garden and some ginger root and then strained it all off. So for the sorbet, all we did was peel the peaches, add the sugar syrup. I used the food processor. However, you can use a blender. So you just churn it into a liquid. Then you pour the liquid right into the ice cream freezer and whirl it away, and there it goes. And it's delicious. It's light. It's, you know, it's summertime in an ice cream scoop.
Yay.
So that was the sorbet.
What a nice thing to do with peaches.
And in between in the class, while we were churning the sorbet and forking the granita, I served them a panna cotta, which is basically, it's another chilled dessert. It's basically where you take... half and half. And we have the panna cotta recipe in the Donalana Kitchen archives, all right? But I've gotten even more streamlined since we posted that panna cotta, which calls for, I think, 2 cups of cream and 1 cup of milk. I just use straight half and half. And then you add gelatin, and the proportions are in the recipe on the website. And I flavored this one I had steeped the cream in black currant leaf, not red currant, but black currant leaf, which has this sort of, it's not vanilla. It has its own distinct but very subtle flavor. So it's basically like a gelatin with cream, and then you pour it into little dishes and you let it set in the fridge. And it is another summertime delight that's easy to make at home.
Yay. And that website is khoifm.org, and you can find the Donalana Kitchen page there and go to recipes. Lots of good stuff.
Panna cotta. P-A-N-A-C-O-T-T-A or something like that. Panna cotta.
Yeah. Panna cotta. There you go. Donna, you have some news items from the Donalana Kitchen News Department.
Yes. One notable thing happened this week. Baby steps in our culture here, but it was announced that both the Coca-Cola Company and the Pepsi-Cola Company have abandoned the plastics lobby.
Now, that's like mountains falling in the distance.
Yeah. And basically the announcement was saying, okay, so there is a lobby that advocates for the plastics industry. Now, we all know that plastics are becoming a global problem. Disposal of unwanted plastics, bottles, all kinds of plastics. It's everywhere. It has become a major source of more or less environmental pollution. They go into the ocean, they degrade, the fish eat them, da-da-da-da-da-da, on and on. It is a not good situation and not improving. And so the plastics lobby obviously was deemed by the Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola company as not a consumer-friendly place to be spending their money.
What in the world are we going to drink our sweetened beverages out of now?
I don't know. It signals to me, and this was not stated in the article, that these companies are, as much as they possibly can, trying to, as we would say, be part of the solution and not part of the problem. I think it did say that both Coke and Pepsi are moving somewhat more towards canned products because aluminum is easier to recycle than plastic. I mean, there are things that on an industrial scale, which may seem like baby steps to us, can make monumental shifts in our culture. And obviously, not that I want to run out and drink Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola, but we do applaud them for their baby steps in becoming aware of these issues. And both of the companies also, I would say, are, because of soda bans and the research that's showing how much soda is related to obesity issues, and it's not such a questionable science anymore, even though a lot has gone into refuting it. Both of those companies are diversifying their products away and making like more bottled water products, more low calorie options. You know, they have seen the writing on the wall.
Oh my goodness.
So, good for them. Good for them.
Good. Well, that's a good, that's, we some have times
we'll call
have,
that good news.
We sometimes have good news, we sometimes have bad news, and that's a
that's
good
not,
news,
that right? is not in our bummer news section. That's
oh,
like, okay.
I take a little.
A little progress is being made.
Take a little time here to talk about, just jump around here, lots of different topics. Curing and harvesting garlic, okay? I happen to report that on my farm we had one dandy garlic harvest this year. And I would say that we have good garlic harvest because, well, three things. We had a good cover crop that was turned under way last fall when it was planted. We had good mulch on it, some spoiled hay. That was good. And when all that stuff was turned under, our sheep had been grazing on it. So three cheers for sheep poo, because I think that happened a lot. So this
year, maybe
it
was the rain too, because last year your garlic tasted good, but the cloves were not as big. Yeah. These are, Lana brought a little basket of the goodies from her garden in, and I mean, these little fresh garlic heads are, they are sculptural. They are beautiful. You can see why people braid garlic and hang them around the kitchen. They are just gorgeous.
That's good. I want to mention that in the Midwest here, or at least on our farm, there's all different kinds of garlic. But we grow a German stiff neck garlic. Oh, I can relate to that. German stiff neck garlic, which is a it grows well here and it keeps well here. There's all different kinds, but
and it has, as I love, as anyone who cooks loves, large cloves.
Yeah, this
because
variety.
Peeling garlic cloves is not my favorite thing, but it is very necessary.
This
so,
variety that we grow has is just lovely,
and they're large and they peel quite easily.
They peel well, and they peel well. So. One harvests these things, so the tops are still sort of green, okay? So the process is harvesting.
Yeah, and you have to visualize them. They're what, like maybe 3 feet long,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
when
yeah.
you pull them
when
out.
When you pull them up, okay? And you bundle them and tie them. I usually
like
tie
how many to a bundle?
Six to a bundle, just because that's what I want to handle. And we toss them up into
and
a hay lift.
And you tie them up with some twine
yeah,
of some
sort. Twine. And I tie them onto a bunch of a big wire woven fence that's hanging up along the side of the haymow. Now you can use garlic anytime. You can pull it up when it's green and use it. You can pull it up immediately and use it. And I have been selling it. But garlic needs to cure if you want to let it last through the winter. And that means storing it like I do in this haymow.
Hanging.
With
so the air, circulates
air,
around.
For about at least 6 to 8 weeks. Then the excess moisture will go out of it and the heads will have their papers pulled tightly around it. You can cut off the stem and it's good to last for a long time. So up to now, which is good. People buy it and use it right away. That's great. You can use it any time. But to make sure they last, curing garlic just means letting it sit there and get dry for a while, and storing garlic, too. Don't put it in the refrigerator, folks. Please don't, unless you're peeling it and putting it in olive oil or something. But leave it in the head. That paper is important. Store it dark and dry. It loves to be dark and dry, like onions.
Well, and then later, because this is this time of year. If you want Joe and Lana's garlic, you got to get it in the next month or so. And so I buy a lot. I let it hang around the house. And then when I feel like maybe it might be starting to get those little green sprouts that I don't want, depends on the weather. But
yeah. After the first of the year, next year,
yeah.
check it. Of January, February.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what I do is I madly peel all that I have left and put them in freezer bags and stick them in the freezer. Now, Joe, Lana's husband, he peels them. He stores them with the papers on.
You can.
Not the whole, you break it into the little
cloves.
Mm-hmm. Right. Not, you don't stick the whole head in the freezer, but there's a point where if you want it to last you all the way till the next harvest, you can freeze it and it works pretty well that way.
Garlic. It's garlic time. Yes, it is.
Can't live without garlic. That is
You're
one
listening.
Of the necessary
yeah.
things.
You are listening to KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM. This is Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was the Flowers of Edinburgh, played on the banjo, as it should be. Yes, it is. The Flowers of Edinburgh, a fine Scottish tune. And speaking of flowers, we're going to take our thoughts to the garden here for a little bit. Japanese beetles. They come every year. Some places, I guess, are just really, really covered with the poor little crunchy things. Our garden has plenty, thank you. I don't need any more. But I've seen worse years.
What are they eating in your garden? They have specific things they like.
Oh, yes. They are eating my raspberries,
The leaves.
My cherry tree leaves, which is fine. The cherries are done, but they just totally denuded.
Yeah, they make it a lot lacy, of flowers. Little brown lacy leaves.
Yeah,
everywhere.
A lot of flowers. Ferns. I have a lot of ferns in the shady spot. Lacy ferns and grapevines. They love grapevines. The little crunchy things are just all over the place, and they do eat. They do eat my basil, but I can kind of keep them off. And Japanese beetles. They come and go. Really, we're kind of on the down cycle. They're going away for the years.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yeah. But they are going to. They lay eggs, and they're going. Our great engineer suggested something called milky spore, which is a little organism you can buy.
That at a garden store or something?
It is biologically. Sort of benign, milky spores, another little organism that fights the little grubs that the Japanese
But how do you make it? How do you get it?
I don't know.
I purchased mine at Earl May, and they have it in big bags.
Okay.
You treat your lawn. The grubs live the larvae live in the lawn.
What do you just sprinkle it around?
You sprinkle it on before a rain, and you have to water it in deeply because it is an organic.
It's sort of alive.
Well, it attacks the grubs when they're in their larva stage. I'm sure if you call Iowa State University and talk to one of their entomologists, they will give you more details about it. But
Milky spore.
They have it at Earl May. You can probably get it online or go to any garden store. A good garden store will have it. If that not, they should order it.
And it's sort of an organic methodology.
Yeah, I had. Those Japanese beetles so bad that they demolished everything in my yard. And then I started using milky spore, and I did it for 3 years in the fall and in the spring and the summer. And I usually had to water it in when I put it in or, if I was lucky, I got it during a rain. And then they were gone.
Yeah.
And I had for quite a few years, I didn't have any, but this year they came back. So I would recommend a treatment for at least 1 year, three times a year to eradicate them when they're in their larvae cycle.
Yeah, a testimonial. And remember, the world is a large space, so these things are flying in all over the place.
Right.
You're not going to get rid of everything, but you can slow them down a little bit. Another thing that showed up with a vengeance in my garden but is gone now, was something called thistle caterpillars. And they, ate all the leaves off of my sunflowers. The sunflower is still up on top, funny-looking things. And they little caterpillars, little tiny little skinny things, brown and fuzzy. And they were on leaves by the hundreds, little icky-looking things. And I found out they were called thistle caterpillars. Not to worry, folks.
If they're caterpillars, do they turn into something else?
Guess what? All those painted lady butterflies that we see, the rather small little thing, those are the painted lady butterflies.
So a thistle caterpillar is a young painted lady butterfly.
See,
and that's why we have so many of them around right now.
We have a purpose for everything, and things do come and things do go. Gardens are so dynamic is the word that gardens can be talked about as. They are always doing. And we must kind of think of not just the bugs changing and there's all this interesting weather that we have. You have another news item, Donna. What did you find out about tomatoes and gardening?
Well, I was reading about a specific. Well, he is a California farmer, and he used to just grow tomatoes. Then he got into tomato breeding, And now the article was about how he has been breeding for drought tolerance and for other climate change things. And I thought, I bet Lana knows something about this, being that she is the tomato maven or the tomato goddess, and she planted 30-some varieties of tomatoes in her garden this year. So, Lana, what are you planting to deal with the changes that we're having?
Well, I'm planting lots of different things. I do it every year, and I'm always amazed at what varieties do well, what varieties do not do well. We had a very cold and wet start to things. Then it got really hot and dry, and we've had some cold weather, hot weather, cold weather. Tomatoes are... they don't like all this change.
Well, they're delicate little ladies there.
They are. And I'm not a scientist. I leave it to people like this Mr. Brad Gates, a small organic farmer, growing tomato breeder, and grower of heirlooms since 2000. He has wild boar farms in California. And see, people that breed things and actually know what they're doing, like keep track of all of these things and make sure that their varieties come out true. And I kind of go by catch can. I try to cover my bases by planting
30 varieties.
All different
sorts.
Something
will work, right?
All different sorts. And I had heard of this person, Mr. Brad Gates from Wild Boar Farms. He shows up in a couple of the catalogs that I order seeds from, and I ordered a variety. I talked about this variety a couple months ago when I was ordering seeds and doing transplants and planting tomato seeds. I ran across one called Mint Julep. And I have it here. Get this. It's also known as Michael Pollan tomato. Uh-huh. It is a new unique plum pear-shaped 1.5-ounce fruits. Have a pleasant tomato taste with a nice overall sweet flavor.
Yeah, and they've got a yellow underskin and it's green on top. It's really pretty.
It is a stripy tomato. A shape like a pear.
I'm going to bite into this one.
It's rather large for a pear tomato. And
delicious.
Yeah.
Nice acidity.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was
actually
pretty good.
A little more flavor. It's about the size of a Roma, which is usually mm-hmm. used for a cooking tomato.
Right.
But this is nice, strong flavor.
I thought it was going to be a cherry size. It's larger mm-mm. than a cherry. Mint julep. And
And it's a beautiful color. I mean, if you want to make a tomato salad, I always like to put a few green tomatoes. Not green as in unripened, but green as in color, like a green zebra or what? Is this a green zebra?
That's a green zebra.
Yeah.
I have been growing green zebras for years, and those are round and mm-hmm. kind of medium-sized. Again, stripy. Now, people are pretty opinionated about their tomatoes. Oh, I could never eat a tomato that is not red. Just close your eyes sometimes. Just close your eyes
Live a little,
and
folks.
Bite.
Come on.
Because there are so many varieties. Now, there's been challenges out there. For one thing, I don't suppose Mr. Brad Gates of the Wild Boar Farm had as much trouble with a groundhog as I did this year. Now, that has nothing to do with climate change unless...
Yeah, how do you breed a tomato that a groundhog doesn't like? Not be very
Boy,
delicious,
Boy, he just wiped
right?
me out way in the beginning. He just nibbled everything. And he still gets in just, well... Every now and then, there's a lot of rabbits this year, too. It eats some of the bottom fruit. But there's also another thing because of the variability. Just here in central Iowa, the variability, I've had real problems with, there's something called blossom end rot, which you pick up a tomato, and the bottom, it looks fine from the top. The bottom is flat and rotten, and that is blossom end rot. That has to do with it didn't get things consistently. The nutrients and the water didn't get to it consistently.
So
and
the, and it either just too sort much of, water and then
yeah,
not
and
enough.
It just sort of aborted halfway through. Hmm. And it's kind of sad because you kind of get half of a fruit there and you think you got something, but you don't. And also, it's amazing to grow tomatoes outside. If rains come at the wrong time when the fruit is setting, they can split because they get too much water all at once. I had quite a lot of split fruit, but
Let's talk about this growing outside, because in my mind, I think that's the way tomatoes grow. Hello. No, it's just like pigs don't grow outside anymore, you know? A lot of tomatoes are grown in either hoop houses around here, because the weather does bring certain problems with it.
It does, surprisingly, and it's wonderful.
And the wind, too, is hard around here sometimes.
It's wonderful to have people that are investing in hoop houses, and that's a sort of semi-inside growing, or in a greenhouse. Now, they don't get the full sun, so I don't know, people say they can taste the difference. Growing outside is a challenge.
It's the good old-fashioned way.
It's the good old-fashioned way, and yes, it is iffy. I don't know, do we know about it more because we are more aware of what's happening around us? But anyway, I get tomatoes. They're funny shaped sometimes. Some other things that I'm growing this year, besides the wild boar series, and this mint julep is part of that wild boar from the Wild Boar Farms. Like I said, I've got
Green zebras.
And these have done well this year. There's a variety called a black crim, but and so I grew a lot of black crims, but also...
You know, I had read, Lana, that these more northern tomatoes, like the ones that came from Russia, for example, and black crim is one of them. I think someone at Seed Savers told me years ago that if you choose those varieties, they will be the best heirloom, most hardy heirlooms that you can grow in Iowa.
I've had pretty good luck with them. And now, of course, people are kind of playing around. This one is called the Black Prince. And there's one called Paul Robeson, too. There's a lot of different black, which aren't really black. They're maroon. Dark brownish maroon,
right.
Dark red.
They're still kind of red, but they have these dark green undertones to them. They're quite pretty. It's obviously an heirloom tomato.
Those are lovely. I've had luck with those, and actually consistently, yes.
Now, the other thing, what are these, the yellow ones? I love the yellow. They're
another heirloom, a French heirloom called a Jean Flamme. Which means
yellow flame. Right.
Small tomato, yellow,
but not a cherry tomato.
No. Kind of, they're a fist size. I call them a salad tomato.
Yeah,
they're orange on the outside,
maybe 2 inches.
Orange on the outside, pink on the inside.
Oh, they're pink on the inside.
One of the tomatoes that I can force on people. You don't like a yellow tomato. Try this one.
Does it have a little more? I mean, yellow tomatoes are known to be low acid tomatoes.
Right. This is kind of a medium. It's a pretty tasty.
Here's another trick that I like to talk about this time of year with yellow tomatoes. So I make a little tomato salsa or a tomato salad using yellow tomatoes and peaches. And since they're all the same color, people think they're getting, or like you can chop it up maybe into half inch pieces and mix it up with a little olive oil and salt and put it on a piece of a baguette, and it's called a bruschetta. But I like to mix the tomatoes and the peaches in together because people don't see the peach coming. They're thinking in their mind, yellow tomato, but the actual flavor of the peach and the tomato, and this is the only time of year when we have them overlapping fresh in the market. It's very fun. It's a little palate fooler. So think maybe making a little fresh salad or salsa with peaches, more tomatoes than peaches, but maybe one third to one quarter peach and the rest yellow tomatoes. And a little fresh chopped basil. It's a good fun thing.
Oh, good. Two more things to talk about here.
Yes.
People always ask for, I want a red tomato. Okay, I'm trying a new kind this year. This one is called Abraham Lincoln, and who couldn't like Abraham Lincoln?
It looks like your classic tomato.
It's classic, and the bigger ones, I didn't bring the big ones. And I like that. This is called a Costoluto. It's an Italian.
Costoluto Constantino.
Yes.
It's a lobed tomato, which means it's like has these
ruffles.
Folds in them. Yeah.
They
are beautiful. And they have great, great flavor.
Yeah. So there's all kinds of tomatoes. And they're just,
do you know how these got brought into the tomato market?
No, I don't.
In the probably mid-90s, an L.A. chef named Evan Clayman, who does the Good Food Show on KCRW, one of the best-known national food shows from Los Angeles. She had a restaurant called Angeli Cafe, and Evan would go at least once a year to Italy. And she came back with these seeds and gave them to one of our favorite farmers to grow out, and people were just like in awe. They were so beautiful. And now they have done really well in this country, which is how I remember Costoludo Constantino. For some
you.
Reason, that got stuck in my brain. I don't know how.
Thank you. Isn't that funny? We kind of have, like I said, people have opinions about our tomatoes, and we kind of get to know them by name, which is very nice.
Well, this is a distinctive tomato with a great flavor and a beautiful name, and you can see the actual Costoludo Constantino at the Onion Creek Farm Stand on Saturdays at the downtown market.
And, like, there's just so many different kind of tomatoes to explore.
And these, when you slice them, you know, because you see the ruffled shape, they're so pretty.
Pretty is good.
So pretty. And delicious. Good flavor one, yes.
Good. So, tomatoes. Kind of thinking about tomatoes and what's going on in the garden. This is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about us, khoifm.org. You can go to the Donna Lana Kitchen page there for archives, recipes. You can contact us by email at khoiradio@gmail.com. Do give us some tomato stories. Welcome back. That was a tune called Little Black Mustache by Bob Black, a fine Iowa banjo player, yes, and a local treasure, I will say. So we're going to talk about a wonderful thing that just our engineer Cynthia carried into the studio, this wonderful, fuzzy, warm-looking thing. She went to a workshop at the Vesterheim Museum in Decorah, Iowa. A lot of Scandinavian stuff happening up there. Cynthia, tell us what you brought in. It's warm, it's fuzzy, it's large. What is it?
It's gorgeous.
It's a Schinfell, and a Schinfell looks, in English, it looks like a skinfell. So it's spelled S-K-I-N-N-F-E-L-L. It's a sheepskin coverlet.
Beautiful, gray, curly, like salt and pepper gray. Oh, it's just so beautiful.
If people watch Vikings, this sheep was raised in Gotland, in that island off, and probably in Sweden. So these are sheep that were raised in Sweden, and they were, you know, but this is taken over to Norway and then turned into, you know, yeah.
So this is folk tradition.
Folk tradition going back. Pre-Viking, probably.
Old ancient skills that we...
These are blankets. These are blankets made out of sheepskin. And I'm part of the Iowa Federation of Weavers and Spinners, and I saw a presentation that they had 3 years plus when last time that the lady that teaches the class, her name is Britt Solheim, Britt Solheim, Solheim. She's a Norwegian folk artist, I would call it, because this is a part of the Norwegian-American folk art school.
So she comes just to teach these old crafts, old ways.
Yeah, and she doesn't come often. I had to wait 3 years for this class, and there was a huge, long waiting list for this.
So you buy the skin already tanned, right?
Yes.
But then you have to sew it together in a certain way?
Yeah. They have armpits, and they look like our women's or men's armpits. You know, there's hair on it, but it's very sparse. So you cut those off, and then you cut a piece to, and you sew it in, and then you sew another piece over that to cover up.
So you're patching the armpits so that you have a square or rectangle shape.
Yeah, some people leave them with the armpits on, and then they do it that way. A little more rustic. But there's a really nice example at Vesterheim. That's Vesterheim at their folk art school. If you go look at previous classes.
Now, is it a museum and a school in Decorah?
Vesterheim Norwegian American Heritage Museum. So this is Norwegians that are proud Americans, and they meld both cultures. So this is their history.
They learn from their grandmothers. Okay.
Yeah, basically, not to forget the history.
It's a lovely museum to visit. It is right on Main Street of Decorah, so you can find it.
Yeah, I'm a member. I married my husband is more Norwegian than I am. I have like a great grandparent that was Norwegian, but he is like at least half Norwegian. So, we go there and visit, and it's a lovely school. And
This is a blanket you've made, right?
This is a coverlet, and it's three sheep. This particular one currently has three sheep hides. I bought three more that I will eventually attach to it, so it'll be fairly big.
Double one, yeah.
I'm trying to make it wider. I made it tall so it covers my feet.
Traditionally, one sleeps with the fur next to your skin, right?
Oh, yeah.
Skin side on you. Oh, it's so cozy.
If you physically lift it up, it's heavy. But once you get it on you, it's like a weighted blanket. It's not as heavy as you think because of the loft of the thing, the fur. And in Norway, that's what they use for blankets.
And coming from a country that is cold and this is a craft that is ancient, it has spiritual and cultural things that you don't just have this blanket on you. There are beautiful things that are painted on these things. It turns it into a special thing. Yeah. Tell us about the images that you incorporated on the skin side, not the fuzzy side, but the skin side of this skin fell.
It's shin fell, and I painted images onto it because traditionally what I did was I stamped them on. Traditionally they would use an alder bark ink, and that's light sensitive, so modernity says we use a fabric ink, but in muted tones of grays and light browns and light golds and stuff. So they use
earth colors,
very something that you can get from a natural dye.
From a plant, yeah.
Yeah. So we used that ink, but we used traditional techniques of alder stamps that are carved in Norway by a gentleman that's his full-time job. He will make you a stamp if you go. I don't have the information on me, but if you contact Vesterheim, I'm sure they have the information there.
There's beautiful allusions in these images to water and trees, the sun.
There are five motifs that a shin fell should have on them. The sun or fire, a water motif, you know, that swirling motif. Animals include humans. So you have to have either some kind of creature or human. And then plants. Plants could be trees or flowers or anything growing in the flora and fauna. And then the fifth thing is the mystery. You know, the things that make life good. They could be things that are protective. I put a labyrinth on mine. I also put hearts on it, which is a symbol of love that's fairly new, you know, motif of love, but things that make life sweet. So you that fifth element. But some people could incorporate that to mean the creator or some kind of protective thing that is the other, you know, whatever. It's kind of flexible in that whatever your beliefs can incorporate that in to be.
This sounds good.
But the labyrinth was meant to keep things from following you home. Like if you're out in the woods and you think some kind of spiritual thing is going to come get you.
Or the wolf. You don't want the wolf to follow you home.
Or the wolf or something, you know, the other. The labyrinth was meant for protection. Or the protection is the people that love you and the people that you love or the things that you love. It's the sweet things in life. So it's all that mystery, that folk tales and those stories that space that is in between, you know, the water and the fire and the people and the animals and the plants.
Well, this work, Cynthia, is a really great reminder because it's ancient.
It goes a little
pre-Christian, lots of other things.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That if any of us go far enough back in our lineage, but we're all kind of mixed lineage at this point, but even white people were once tribal. We were all small bands of peoples all over the earth, mm-hmm. and we have lost a lot of our traditions.
This is the closest thing to Native American culture I have ever found. And I grew up in Northern California, and I went to a place called Hoopa High. And Hoopa is one of the few tribes that didn't get taken off their tribal land. So mm-hmm. I've been to Native American dances. They had brush dances. They have two high dances, a boat dance and a white deerskin dance. They have I got to see all that. And mm-hmm. that's like I thought it was amazing. Mm-hmm. And the people are very proud of it, but they're very, very, very protective. Because when the whites came, they took all their regalia, which is kind of a spiritual money, a spiritual currency, a spiritual connection with each other.
And also their history books. Their regalia, like the beads, count the years that this happened.
It's the story of who they are. That was taken away, so they're very protective of their space and their tribe and their people, and they don't talk about it. And if they do, they do it in a kind of guarded fashion because it is sacred. So this is the thing about Norway, and our teacher discussed that, or her daughter did, is that the Christians couldn't take this part out of the Norwegians.
These are the images and these skins.
Well, they needed those sheepskins to stay warm.
There was a practical quality
tradition.
To it.
Tradition,
But they keep these usually up in the mountains away from, you know, modernity, and they use them when they're camping in the spring around Easter and things.
Oh.
So it's
a wonderful thing.
Yeah, I have mine. I've been sleeping with it.
It is the most gorgeous thing, Cynthia. Thank you for bringing it.
I'm glad you guys are enjoying
it. Yeah, and we learned. We learned that sheep have armpits. That's good.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you. I'm glad I was able to share it. Go to Vesterheim Folk Art School to learn more about their classes and
right
and
here
what
in Iowa.
About.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Very good. We're going to mention a few upcoming things here. Roosevelt Summer Sundays here in Ames. There's two more Roosevelt Summer Sundays.
Concerts
happening.
Two more.
This is a great way to use concerts. Yeah, go to concerts. Yeah. And a local foods potluck is coming up Sunday, August 24th, sponsored by the local food co-op. And let it be known far and wide that KHOI is having our 7th annual birthday celebration Sunday, August 11th in the parking lot behind KHOI Studio, 416 Douglas, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m.
Live music.
Oh, yes. Free concert by Rocky Raccoon. And cake. So come. It'll be fun. Food will be provided by Burgers on the Fly food truck. So come down to a free concert. Celebrate a birthday. This is good. 11 years. We don't look a day over 39, do we?
No.
11 years. Good job, KHOI. Support this fine radio station. You've been listening to the Donalana Kitchen on this KHOI community radio station that is going to soon be published, or soon be having its birthday. There's lots of summer left. Roll down the windows and put on an 8-track tape. Drive the back roads. We will go out with a tune by the Everly Brothers. Why not? It's a summer sort of thing. Thanks for joining us today. Support Community Radio. My name is Lana Nakigo.
And I'm Donna Kuzkintas.
We had excellent engineering by Cynthia McClure and good information, too, about sheep and fitness. Eat good food and enjoy life.
She sure looks happy, I sure am blue. She was my baby. I'm gonna cry high.